So maybe a first question would be, give us a state of just your tribes. Madison has just been designated in December, Truax Field, as the home of F35A. Doctor, can you start? Give us an overview. Wisconsin has interviewed Peter Barkas several times when he was the leader of Assembly Democrats as a state representative from Kenosha. But in January, new job, state revenue secretary, responsible for, I looked it up, collecting $35 billion in the next biennium. Peter, quite a transition. Congratulations. How do you like your new job?
I love it. Thank you very much. It's very interesting. In addition to handling tax 3.1 million tax filers every year, we have our state and local finance division that has terrific relations with all our local officials all across the state. And we have our research and development division that has all the economists that do all the economic forecasts. We just brought back our quarterly economic forecast to try and help businesses to make investment decisions. And then we have what I call our entertainment division, the lottery, which has gotten a lot of news lately.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of elements to this, not even mentioning alcohol, gaming, and tobacco enforcement.
Right. Well, you hit on several points that I want to talk about. So the 3.1 million filers.
Mm-hmm.
The filing date, of course, the deadline was April 15th. What percentage now e-file?
Well, it's interesting. Last year, we were at an all-time high at 87%.
87%.
Now, as of May 4th, we are at 93%. However, we're still processing that 800,000 returns that came in the last week. So it'll probably drop down, but we'll be pretty close to 90% of all filers filing electronically, which is terrific for so many reasons. It's good for the individual because they're more accurate. You get your refund quicker. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, 90% of the cases, we get refunds back to people within 6 business days, which is pretty impressive as an organization. But it's also, better for us because it's less costly, less paper you have to handle. For paper returns, we have to scan them all. And then we have this validation department that has to go through with this sophisticated software that puts boxes around numbers that are hard to read. And so it's a lot more guesswork.
Your agency hires a bunch of LTEs close to the tax season. Don't you
yes,
hire,
we do.
Hire hundreds
yes,
to
we
open
hire,
the mail and properly
process? Yes, we hire 100 to 200 LTEs every tax season. And a lot of those are handling paper returns. But we would need LTEs even if everybody e-filed. But the bulk of them, or at least a substantial portion of them, are because of people's sloppy handwriting like mine. That's why we file.
You made reference to one of your divisions projects how Wisconsin's economy is going to do. Now, in the first 9 months, general purpose revenues were up 5.4%, which mm-hmm. is a pretty handsome jump.
Mm-hmm.
So what are your economists telling you are in store for the next 2 years, the next biennial budget?
Well, first let me say that we're expecting 2.2% GDP growth over the course of the next year is what we're projecting.
That's gross domestic product.
That's exactly okay. Right. We're projecting personal income growth at 3.8%, which is very important. And we're projecting wages and salaries, a percentage, to go up by 3.9%. So that's pretty vibrant growth. So we expect, that the economy will be strong. We expect good growth. We expect low unemployment, which is terrific for workers, but challenging at times for employers. And
yep.
That's why the governor is so focused on closing the skills gap and putting more money in education and partnerships with the private industry. And so we're expecting good growth, though.
Do your economists see the potential for a recession in the next biennium, Peter, which starts July 1?
Well, one thing I'd say is that economists never predict a recession because they're afraid of a self-fulfilling prophecy. But at least for the next year, which is the most easy to predict, we do not believe there'll be a recession in the next year.
Okay. And then your entertainment division.
Yes.
You recently met a young man, 24-year-old, who won the third largest Powerball in the history of Powerball.
Right.
So that's worth, just in additional state income taxes, $38.9 million?
It's wonderful, isn't it? It helps mitigate everybody else's taxes just by the fact that, this young man was a lucky guy. And one story I'd love to share with you, Steve,
please,
is that, so Wisconsin's an average-sized state, right? We're, right in the middle of the pack. We're actually low in terms of number of lottery tickets. We're 31st in terms of number of lottery tickets that we buy. However, we're 6th in terms of winnings. So Wisconsin's a lucky state. So if you live in Wisconsin, you're a lucky person. In fact, I told our tourism director at a cabinet meeting a couple weeks ago, I said, well, maybe we should say, you know, come to Wisconsin and get lucky. But they didn't like that for other reasons, I guess.
We're 30th in sales, but 6th in wins?
Isn't that remarkable?
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
that is absolutely
fantastic.
I guess
we're a lucky city. Better to be lucky than smart, I guess.
After that gentleman...
we're bold.
you're right. After that gentleman took the lump sum, and Wisconsin's going to get 38.9, and the Feds are going to get, do you remember?
I don't know exactly, but, you know, close to triple that.
And the retailer is going to get like, is it 100,000?
They get, yeah, caps out at 100,000. You get 2%, but it caps out at 100 grand, and, you know, it's still a nice day's work.
Well, on the day of that press conference with, I think his name is Mr. Franco.
Yes, that's right.
Speaker Voss put
Manuel
out a press
Franco.
Release. Yep, Manuel Franco, congratulations. Speaker Voss put out a press release, and he doesn't think that the names of the big lottery winners should have to be made public. Now, this decision was made in the 1980s when we started the lottery. Have you got a position on whether names like Mr. Franco should be made public?
Well, I don't want to sound old, but I was there in the 80s when we made that decision. And there was a lot of thinking around that. Not every state does require it to be public, but the vast majority do. And they do it because of transparency purposes. They do it for the integrity of the system. And he was a perfect example because the answer I think I love most was when he said, well, you know, I'm just an ordinary guy that won the lottery. So people can realize that it's not a rigged system. It's not some insider that's getting this money. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in Iowa, you had this guy named Tipton that in fact, did rig the system.
He rigged it.
In fact, he's been prosecuted successfully.
Yes.
And part of the reason that they found out is because his name was public. The person who won became public, and you know, they found out it was his brother. And so, you know, if something like that occurs through having a lot of eyes and people that know people watch this, you can catch it. So I think that historically it's been transparent for a reason. I know virtually every state has it that way. And I'll bet you, Steve, if you won $460 million, you wouldn't mind going public.
I wouldn't mind going public. I'd like to have that problem. But what's the threshold beyond which your name has to be made public? I mean, isn't there some basic threshold?
Because There is. And
if I win like $20 in cash at a convenience
public,
store. Right.
And I can't remember anymore if it's $50,000 or, you know, but it's an amount that's, you know, something that is, you know, somewhere around a person's average wages for the year. So once it reaches that level, you know, where it's a significant amount, I think people want to know that their lottery ticket had just as much chance as anybody else. So that's the thinking behind it.
Does revenue ever circle back to some of these large winners to say, hey, any follow-up? Are you aware of any follow-up to people like Mr. Franco? Will DOR contact him to say how it's going in a year or two?
No, we really don't. I mean, we respect a person's privacy, and once they win, they're off on their own. And, you know, sometimes people will check back in. And I'll tell you another interesting story that came out of this is, you know, we asked them, what'd you do with the ticket? How'd you secure it? And this is something that our lottery staff regularly ask people. Mm-hmm. And it's remarkable to hear the story. Some people tape it to their thigh. Some people put it in their pillowcase. Some people put it in the freezer. You know, the most important
winning
thing.
Winning tickets?
The winning tickets. The most important thing is to sign it, though, to validate that you're the winner. But people have all kinds of protocols because normally these winnings are announced in the evening. The bank isn't open. You can't really go validate your ticket, generally speaking, in most places.
And
if it's a big winner, then you want to wait and plan your financial future accordingly.
So somewhere in the bowels of your agency, Revenue, there's a list of all the major winners? There has to be, right?
Well, I'm sure that we keep very close tabs on that. I've never really looked at that list, but you know, obviously it's all transparent. There's public records there.
And you cannot play.
I cannot play. I'm barred from playing, as
yes,
is my deputy, as is the lottery director, and all of her staff. We can't play.
Okay, but Wisconsin realized $38.9 million when Mr. Franco got lucky.
We'd like to see some more lucky Wisconsin people
we're number
bringing
six
those
in
big
winnings.
Numbers, you know, right?
Right. Okay, let's turn to Governor Evers' budget.
Yes.
He recommended major changes in Wisconsin tax structure. Mm-hmm. Changes that we would not have seen for decades. So he recommended, I'm going to ask you about each of these. He recommended a major middle income tax cut.
Yes, very important.
Why is that so important?
Well, the reason why it's important, and you know, I in my new role as well as even in my previous role, I give a lot of speeches around the state. I speak to a lot of business groups. whether it be the NFIB, who was on a panel at WMC, the Independent Business Association, Waukesha Business Alliance. I even spoke to the Kenosha Chamber just a week ago. But I mean, that's just an example of the many groups that I speak to. And regardless of how progressive or how conservative the group is, I always say I'm going to tell you one thing that I believe is a truth, and I want you to challenge me if you think I'm wrong. I said, what makes America and what made Wisconsin the economic envy of the world was having a strong, vibrant middle class. I've never had anybody challenge me on that. And the issue is that as goes the middle class, as goes the economy, because if people have money in their pocket and they're doing well, they're going to buy goods and services from the small, medium-sized, and even large businesses, and that's what gets the economy revved up and going. And so what the governor, in recognition of that principle, he would provide for people, as you know, nearly $1 billion in tax relief to middle and lower middle-income people. 1.9 million of the 3.1 million filers would see significant and substantial tax relief. So, you know, virtually two-thirds of the citizens of this state would get a benefit, and it's disproportionately balanced towards those who are working hard for modest wages. So if you're working for $9, $10, $11 an hour, if you combine that with the earned income tax credit, you're going to give you more relief, because the idea is that people are doing the right thing. They're getting up every morning, working 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year, staying off of welfare. We want to make sure that they can support their family in dignity. So that's the reason behind it. But he also wants to help people up to $150,000 for families, $100,000 for individuals. Mm-hmm. So people even of, you know, the upper middle class get a benefit out of this, and that's as it should be. But we all win, because if, in fact, people have this money in their pocket, they're going to, you know, fix their roof, they're going to buy their kids new shoes, they're going to go out and maybe get tutoring for their kid on a particular topic they have an issue with, they're going to buy a new furnace, a new car, and that stimulates the economy. So it really is an economic growth provision as well.
But what about the response to the governor's veto of the Republican tax package? Mm-hmm. You heard, you read the press releases from Speaker Boss and Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald. If you believe that everything you just said, why mm-hmm. veto then that first tax package?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Two reasons. First of all, the governor asked me to go testify before the Ways and Means Committee, which I did. And I said, I'm here for one basic reason. Let's make a deal. Let's work together. Our packages are not that dramatically different. I was heartened to see that they did want to give tax relief focused to the middle class, which was very different than the Walker years, where disproportionately the tax breaks are given to those at the very top with the trickle-down philosophy. Only rarely does it trickle down to middle-income people. So I said, we can work this out. But unfortunately, they never met with the governor. They never tried to come up with a compromise. But then the second provision the governor felt very strongly about is, let's finance it. Let's not just keep borrowing more money. I mean, we've had more debt in this state than, you know, especially in transportation, than we've had in decades, and that's not healthy. So he wanted to have this package financed, but he was very willing to sit down and work out a compromise. But, you know, these things are easier when they're done in the budget. Why is that the case? Because the Republicans are never going to finance a package as a singular bill, because they want to have this perception that they'll never raise a tax or a fee or anything, mm-hmm. You know, even if it, you know, helps middle-income people and disproportionately maybe gets a little bit more from those who have done very well over the course of the last decade. So I knew they weren't going to do that, so that's why the governor said, well, then let's just do it in the budget.
Well, Joint Finance is going to begin voting on the budget tomorrow.
Yes.
And it's going to be a 4, 5, or 6 week process, but a process that you're well aware of. But here's my bottom line question. If there's no middle-income tax cut in the Republican budget, should he veto the entire budget?
Well, it's a decision the governor's going to have to make at that time. I mean, I suspect and I hope and trust, and I'm working towards this end, the governor's working even harder than I am on this, is to have meetings with Republicans, to talk over different options, to try and come together. Because at the end of the day, you know, I'd like to see us return to the days of, you know, the Tommy Thompson type era, where you had a governor in one party, a legislature in the other, and you rolled up your sleeves and you got things done. I mean, the state has been so polarized the last 8 years. And that's the last thing we need right now, and that's the last thing the governor wants. A governor is not a politician. He's an educator. You know, he came from the world where you do work together, where it doesn't matter if you're Democrat or Republican. You just say, okay, how can we solve these problems? And that truly is what he would like to accomplish. So I'm hoping that, you know, as we get closer to the end, we can have those critical conversations and do what's right. I mean, you know, and really the governor's budget is all about, you know, middle income tax break, you know, fund education, infrastructure, and roads, make those a little bit better for everybody, and take care of people's health care. It's bread and butter type issues that people really care about.
You're right in that Governor Evers recommended paying for his middle income tax cut and other tax changes by, let's look at the biggest big ticket items, limiting the manufacturing and ag credit. Mm-hmm. And that would have been $516 million that could have been applied to these other tax code changes. And limiting the capital gains, non-farm capital gains, mm-hmm. which the Fiscal Bureau scores at $505 million. Peter, my question is this. Are the highest income Wisconsin residents not paying their fair share?
Well, I think the governor feels very strongly that they could afford to help a little bit more, that especially under the Walker years, they're the ones that got the lion's share of the tax breaks. Mm-hmm. And he's not trying to eliminate tax breaks from even these people. He's just saying, let's trim it back a little bit. Let's make it a little bit more reasonable. You know, the manufacturer's break, for instance.
The manufacturing, I mean, and ag.
Which right. Now, well, not egg. The egg he took out because right. He recognizes the situation that farmers are in right
and,
now.
And let's straighten that out so people are clear. He recommended that that ag still continue to get the tax break.
Right.
He wanted to put a limit on the manufacturing side.
Right. He was saying that at $250,000, he's saying that if you're a manufacturer, the first $250,000 that you bring in production income is tax-free, that we want you to reinvest in Wisconsin. We don't want it. It'll still be better than most states in the nation. But, you know, but if you're making $100 billion, I mean, why shouldn't you at least pay a little bit to help fund our roads, help fund our schools, help make sure that, you know, we have quality systems here in Wisconsin? The other thing that I really think is very vital that many people probably aren't aware, and that's why I appreciate the opportunity to help educate people. The thing that some of the largest employers in this state told me personally, mm-hmm. they flew in, met with me at the Department of Revenue 2 weeks before the budget was due. And they said what would be more important to us than even this manufacturer's credit is the research and development credit. We have a 10% refundable credit. They said Wisconsin's, you know, a little bit below average here. If you could boost that, it would make a big difference for us. And the rationale was, they said, then we'll invest more in research and development. We'll develop new products here. That'll generate new income. I brought that to the governor, and being an educator, someone that supports science and research and investment, he said, okay. In fact, he doubled it, went from 10% to 20%. Mm-hmm. So he totally gets, you know, the importance of economic growth. And that's what we heard from some of the largest employers in this state. There were about 10 or 12 of them represented in this one meeting alone. And there are many others that couldn't make it there. But they told us, please, if there's one thing you could do that would make a difference that is more important even than the manufacturer's credit, do this research and development. The governor listened, and he put in his budget. I hope the Republicans keep that.
Well, I wonder, is that on the list of 70-plus items that the Republicans are about to dump? From
well,
the budget, just
well,
the R&D
right.
going from 10 to 20%.
You know, I'm not sure, to be
okay.
frank. I haven't seen the final
but
list.
It should be part of their final budget.
It hasn't been one of the more flashier items that has gotten the attention. It should, though, because I know it's important to business industry in this state. But I'm not sure if they're going to keep that or not. But I know in my discussions, I've been urging them to keep it.
Well, the manufacturing and ag credit, the current law, Peter, is projected to cost, this is a Fiscal Bureau number, $600 million in the next biennium. Mm-hmm. Does most of that go to the richest Wisconsin taxpayers?
It does. Oh, by far. Disproportionately, it benefits those at the very top of the economic ladder. But that's not the beef. It's not that it's not like the governor feels like we want to, you know, it's not like we're trying to target one specific group or another. It just has to do with an equity standpoint. Take Judy Faulkner, who owns Epic.
Yes.
You know, probably the single most important company for ending the brain drain in Wisconsin. You know, she's got, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people, most of whom are under 30 years of age. She doesn't benefit from that. So she pays from dollar one. She wouldn't even get the $250,000 exclusion that the governor would continue to have for manufacturers. Her industry is equally important to this state as manufacturing. And there are many others like that. You take financial services, very important part of this state. So from an equity standpoint, granted, we do want to focus on manufacturing. The governor recognized that by keeping that, you know, and saying the first $250,000, you know, don't pay taxes on that, but at least help out a little bit. Trim it back a little. Help out when you're at those really high limits.
He also recommended a $5,000 per year tax deduction if you're saving for a first home. Now, I checked with Fiscal Bureau. The Republicans haven't dumped that. They're going to keep that as part of the budget. So that's part of the governor's emphasis on helping middle-income residents.
Absolutely. And it's important. You know, own a piece of the rock. You know, invest. That's your savings for many people for their retirement. And, neighborhoods are improved when people buy homes as opposed to strictly renting and leasing. So it's an important provision for many aspects.
And I want to ask you about two other things. The governor recommended raising the earned income tax credit, you mentioned it earlier, and raising the homestead tax credit so more Wisconsin residents could be eligible.
That's at the end. Just one point, if you don't mind. That's at the opposite end of the economic cycle, because that really helps people, those very modest levels, people that are staying off of welfare by doing the right thing, going to work every day.
And tomorrow, Joint Finance, the Republicans are going to dump several of these provisions. No, let me rephrase that. Some of the governor's proposed changes in the tax code. So your reaction to what appears to be their vote tomorrow to dump most of your tax fairness changes, mm-hmm. most of the governor's tax fairness changes?
Well, I think it's unfortunate. And I think if you talk to the average citizen in Wisconsin, if you could poll or do focus groups on this, there is not a shred of doubt in my mind how it would end up. Because people recognize we need to support, a strong, vibrant middle class. You know, let me mention one thing on the homestead credit. Mm-hmm. The most significant moment I've had since I've been at Revenue, there have been a lot of them. There's been some wonderful moments. But in the middle of that blizzard with that freezing cold weather, on the first day that you could file taxes, I went to our Milwaukee office because I was speaking to the Restaurant Association in Milwaukee that next morning. And so it took me, normally I can get to that office in about 45 minutes from my home. It took me over 2 hours to get there. Mm-hmm. It was horrendous weather. I think the governor made an optional day. People could take a personal day that day. I think we had about a third of the people that made it in the office that day. I brought some donuts and everything for those people that made it in. But our lobby was full of people. I've never seen so many people. I'm thinking, who are these
coming
people?
Coming out in a snowstorm?
In a blizzard. In fact, I went around and walked around and talked to people. What brings you in here in this, just godforsaken weather that we got today? Oh, I need help to get that homestead credit. It shows how vitally important, and most of them were there because of the home, almost all of them were there because of the homestead credit, because they need to get that refund to help to pay their property taxes or help support their family. So these credits, and as a legislator, I always knew they were important. But until I took this job, I never quite realized just how significant these credits really are. And that's why, with the Republicans, they didn't have me testify before finance. They only brought in about 6-7 cabinet secretaries.
Yep.
But I wish I could have been there to share that with them, because I wish I could have brought them with me to see the looks on these people's faces and to go out in that type of weather. That's how vital this is. And that's what we're talking about here, helping those people, who have worked their whole life in terms of homestead credit. They're now trying to just get enough to keep their, to be able to stay in their homes. And, we need to focus on people like that that help build this great state.
A couple other issues that involve your agency. The dark store controversy. The governor put in his budget that you cannot value an empty, value a open business doing productive store. You cannot value it according to an empty or closed or dark store.
Right.
Why do you feel so strongly that we need that the governor's original proposal should become law?
Well, and it's not just me. A majority of both houses last session signed on the bill. In fact, I'll never forget when we went in that last month of the floor period, we were in caucus and I was analyzing this and I said, look, I read off about 9 people in caucus. I said, just 3 of you sign on the assembly, we get 2 more in the Senate. We'll have a majority in both houses. So we got them. We went on the floor. There was a joint session. I think it was the governor's State of the State. And I went up to Senator Tim Carpenter, Senator LaTanya Johnson. I said, you haven't signed on this bill yet. If you sign on, oh, definitely, I'll sign. They signed on. So with that last floor period, we had a majority of the legislators in both houses. So had the Republican leadership allowed us to take a vote, it obviously would have passed overwhelmingly. So it's not just how the Governor Evers feels, how I feel. All the polling, this was on a referendum in so many communities across the state, and in every case it passed absolutely overwhelmingly. So vitally important. We had a legislative council committee. Unfortunately, they didn't resolve this. So now it's time for the legislature to roll up their sleeves and to get the job done.
Who blocked it? Which special interest blocked dark store reform?
Well, WMC specifically, but there were others as well. But they were by far the primary one that they testified in committee. And they just said, look, you know, we just absolutely don't want you to do this. You cannot bring this forward. And it's unfortunate because they're listening to some of their larger businesses that are these big box stores. The mom and pop stores recognize what it is. I mean, the Restaurant Association last session, you know, we're on file to change this because these restaurants, they're not getting the same benefits of these huge, you know, stores at 200,000 square feet or more.
Right.
And everybody should just pay their fair share. That's all we're asking.
Are you up to speed on the wedding barn controversy? Has that been resolved?
No, it has not been resolved yet. We continue to work on this. It's one of the more vexing issues I face. Let me tell you about my meetings on confirmation with some of the senators. I would sit down and invariably most of them would say, well, how about those wedding barns? And I said, you know what? Good point. I said, here, tell me what you want me to do. Good luck. I really wish you well. Because it's a tough issue because people recognize, you know, what's at stake here is on, you know, on the one end of the equation, you know, when you say, well, they should just be licensed, in many communities, there's no licenses available, so you'd be effectively shutting them down. On the other end of the spectrum, you know, I think from a safety standpoint, you know, making sure that they're following at least, the basic protections and just educating people when they're leasing out these facilities so that they can, you know, get their building permits, occupancy permits.
And somebody
just
serving
basic
alcohol.
Information would make some sense.
Some of these people serving alcohol in a wedding barn have not had the bartender recognition program mm-hmm. to know when someone has had too much.
Right.
So are you not hopeful that, you use the term vexing, the wedding barn controversy can be resolved?
I honestly think it can. I mean, you know, in fact, the governor had asked us, to meet with a number of the various parties. We met with all of them at this point. We had a group meeting, and we're working aggressively to see if we can't get to a solution. And ideally, you come up with somewhat of a win-win there, you know, where you're making sure that, you know, like for the alcohol training, that kind of stuff takes mm-hmm. place. On the other spectrum, you're not going to shut down a business that's been operating for 10 years and just can't, are in a location where they can't get a license.
Is your agency involved at all in the Foxconn controversy, or is that Weedick and
well,
like that?
The governor is assigned, you know, obviously Secretary Hogan at WDC, but then Secretary Brennan, who has been very intimately involved, and myself. And Secretary Brennan and I serve as ex officio members of the WDC board.
Yes.
And we've been having weekly either phone calls or meetings with Foxconn and in order to make sure that we're making progress, that this is moving forward in a very positive manner. And, you know, the governor has reached out and had countless meetings now with top, you know, officials at Foxconn. In fact, Chairman Goh was here just a week ago.
Yes.
And
yes.
Louis Wu, who's, you know, the second most significant person in Foxconn. We just met with him this past week. So there have been plenty of meetings. And I think, we're just working very aggressively. And the Foxconn personnel are telling us. They feel like, you know, Governor Evers is listening and the rest of us that he's assigned to monitor this are working in a very constructive manner
so
trying to get these buildings built and try and start operations.
You expect a manufacturing facility to open at some point in
yes.
the next 18 months?
That's right. The Gen 6 plant should open by the end of next calendar year. And they've attested that that's their goal. They told us they're on track to meet that goal. And so that'll really be a plus.
Okay.
Bring a whole new technology.
We're almost out of time. Do you get the idea that Republicans who control the legislature are willing to talk about the governor's changes to the tax structure, all the things we've been talking about, middle income tax cut, limiting the manufacturing and ag, limiting capital gains? Is there going to be talks to reach a compromise, or is your team going to be shut out on some of these tax code changes?
Well, I'm hoping in the final analysis, obviously the governor has a veto pen. So at the end of the day, he can veto the whole budget or, you know, line item veto, depending on what's before him. And the Republicans recognize that.
They should keep that option alive.
And Governor Tommy Thompson encouraged them to. On one of the talk shows just in the last month or so, he said, look, my advice to him is he should use that veto pen regularly. I think the governor would prefer not to use a veto pen. I think he'd prefer to sit down and negotiate reasonable compromises, and that means everybody has to give a little. It's like anything in life. You can't have a successful business, a successful organization, or a successful marriage if you're not willing to give and take a little bit.
So you are very happy in this new role. You find it invigorating?
Very much so. It's been, we've done a lot of good things already. It's a good agency that works hard. In fact, one of the things I'm most proud of and something I've really emphasized since I've gotten there, but they already knew it, and now we're just trying to enhance it a little bit. But like customer service, if you can believe it, when you're calling to find out information about your taxes, or let's say the compliance people are collecting from you and you call up to resolve it, a gentleman that worked for us who was visually impaired, back 10, 20 years ago, said, we should tape record these calls. We should rate ourselves. So every call is tape recorded. After we're done, we ask people to fill out a short survey, 2-3 questions. Over a third, or roughly a third, actually fill this out. And we get ratings of well over 99% that people are satisfied. They felt people were professional and helpful. I would compare that very favorably with any credit card company.
Revenue Secretary Peter Barca, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you so much, Steve. Great to be back with you again.
$35 billion in general purpose taxes over the next 2 years. Thanks for the update.
Great to be with you. Thank you so much, Steve. Appreciate you keeping people informed.
Thank you.